You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. My name's Dick Gordon. Our number's 1-800-423-8255. With me on the program today, Paul Stamets. He's a mycologist and an expert in the cultivation and growth of mushrooms. And as our last caller indicated, Paul, you're also in the business of selling the mushrooms for people who use them as medicine and people who would like to use them for cultivation. If it's as remarkable, why is it that the pharmaceutical companies haven't elbowed you out of the way and sort of taken over the old growth forests and embraced the mycelial mats as you know, the next big thing?
They are. There is an enormous interest by the pharmaceutical industry right now in mushrooms, and the genome is being carefully surveyed. There's an article that came out. Dr. Frank Perano from the University of Wisconsin Medical School has now identified a new class of antiviral medicines. This one compound is called RC-183 that comes from the gypsy mushroom, Rosites caparata. And it is effective against the herpes simplex 1 and 2, the varicella zoster virus, and influenza A. I mean, this is the tip of the iceberg. There are novel antibiotics being isolated from mushrooms every year. There's one called Calvacin, which comes from Calvacia gigantea, the giant puffball. Mushrooms don't like to rot because of bacteria. They want to reproduce. We share a more common ancestry with fungi than we do with any other kingdom. We also respire CO2 as the mushroom mycelium does, and we absorb oxygen. It's very interesting that we share in common many of the diseases that fungi are afflicted by, but we don't share in common the diseases that plants are afflicted by. We have a much more common biological health system in common with fungi than we do with other animals.
Are you saying that these mycelial mats, these under-the-ground networks of mushroom roots, if I can call them that, and I'm just trying to sort of keep it in a layman's understanding, are more animal than they are vegetable?
Yes, indeed. In fact, the mycology department should be in the zoology departments of universities, not in the botany department.
Why?
Because 460 million years ago, we share a common ancestor with fungi. The fungi went the path of digesting its nutrients externally, and our path was a path that encapsulated nutrients, i.e., in a stomach, and that was our path. So we are much more closely associated with fungi, and as a result, fungal infections of humans are very difficult to treat, but the bacterial infections are easily treatable by the fungal medicines because of our common ancestry.
Let me ask you a question, Paul, though. When you're both in the position of being a scientist that's studying it and then being a businessman who's selling it, do you get challenged? Because, oh, well, of course you'll say this mushroom is good for that because you can make money selling it or selling the spore.
Well, there is a dialectic here. I do publish in juried peer-reviewed journals. I'm one of the editors of the International Journal of Medicinal Mushrooms. University professors are paid by the their professors. My business pays me. You know, we're all in the same game together. I did not go on to get my PhD because I started a business and I had two small children.
Right.
But so much of our money in research is spent specifically on understanding the role of mushrooms in nature and in medicine, and as a result, I'm a co-investigator on several NIH applications, specifically looking, for instance, at oyster mushrooms. Oyster mushrooms contain lovastatin. Lovastatin is a FDA-prescribed anti-cholesterol drug. There is statistically significant amounts of lovastatin in oyster mushrooms. A study by Gunn Zimmerman, who first isolated this compound, found that if you ate 15 grams of oyster mushrooms per day in 30 days, you could reduce your LDLs by 30%. Now, this is a complicated issue now because lovastatin is an FDA-approved drug, and it's present in a food that you can buy in the store. So now we have, and this is what should come to the forefront of the American consciousness. Mushrooms are medicinal foods. You are what you eat. And by bolstering your immune system and having multiple mushroom sources, you are able to help your immune system to be able to stave off a whole host of virulent diseases.
But let's go back to people who are waiting to get on the phones. 1-800-423-8255. Providence, Rhode Island. Catherine's on the line. Hello, Catherine.
Hi.
Go ahead.
Oh, okay. Well, I've always been fascinated by mushrooms, and you know, so I'm really enjoying what you're saying. But I was just wondering if you've sort of come up with a metaphor of some sort for the relationship between humans and mushrooms, or you know, humans and fungi. How you see the relationship?
Go ahead, Paul.
Well, I wasn't speaking very well before about my concept of the Earth's natural internet. I believe that fungi will be found throughout the universe. It is an inevitable consequence of matter. I'm not alone in believing that life will exist elsewhere in the universe. And these are neurological landscapes. They're only one cell wall away from billions of microbes. In a single gram, there can be hundreds of billions of colony-forming units. There are so many organisms in the soil. And for the mycelium to be one cell wall away and yet able to survive against legions of other competitors suggests to me a type of environmental intelligence. And I think this archetype of the of the mushroom mycelium, of brain neurons, of the computer internet, and then in the organization of dark matter. There was an interesting article in the November 2nd issue of the New York Times talking about the self-creating universe. It also follows this mycelial archetype. You know, this is an archetype of nature, and I believe that as time goes on, that we will see that this archetype is pervasive. It is one of the constants of the universe. So in that sense, I think that we're all part of this neural network. And as science will either prove me correct or not, but there's other people that believe the same thing. For instance, NASA has a Department of Astrobiology. There is now Cambridge University Press has come out with the International Journal of Astrobiology. Now, these are very well-funded institutions and very well-respected, and they're already setting the path for understanding how organisms exist elsewhere throughout the universe, and I believe that fungi will be found on other planets. And I look forward.
Let's move on if we can. I want to say thanks to Catherine for calling in, and go to Rowley, Massachusetts, and Jim's on the line. Jim.
Good morning, gentlemen.
Hi, thanks for calling.
This is a fascinating subject. My initial reason for calling was the use of fungi to help reduce the biomass that's in the our landfills, but you hit on an interesting subject, the one that hits me personally. I have high cholesterol, and so now I guess I have a second question. And has there been any studies with the European diet and their use of mushrooms and low cholesterol?
Paul?
Not that I know of, but the Europeans don't eat as many mushrooms as the Japanese, and there have been studies specifically in Japan about the health benefits in using mushrooms in their diet. I don't remember specifically the pounds per capita, but I think it's on the order of 12 to 15 pounds of mushrooms are being eaten by the average Japanese consumer per year. In the United States, I think we're approaching around 2 pounds per se. So you know, we have a big difference between the two.
Let's go back to Jim's first point, though, that idea that landfills can be filled in with mushrooms, or the landfill people can use mushrooms to speed the decomposition. Is that the right word? Or composting?
Well, why fill landfills? Why not compost at home? I think that when people put their brush and their decomposable garbage on the street to be hauled off to some other landfill site, they are robbing their own carbon bank. They should be composting that right in situ on their property, because once you move, once you have all these twigs and leaves and grass clippings and you take it off, then what do you have to do in order to have a healthy yard? You add fertilizer. So it is a self, you know, it certainly helps the fertilizer companies, but it is a spiral downwards.
But let's talk about landfills, because they are a fact. So somebody's got a landfill in their neighborhood and they're listening to you talk about the capabilities of mushrooms. Could the mushrooms be used to speed the transformation of that waste into usable soil?
Absolutely. The end consequence of the decomposition of wood is soil. These are the grand soil builders on the planet.
But that would count for plastic bags and disposable diapers and everything that's in a landfill?
Well, you know, the plastics are harder to decompose, but there's bacterial strategies. And see, as the mycelial mats decompose and then age, then they become a platform for bacteria to grow. So you get this whole symphony of organisms working in concert. These are keystone species that lead to a whole panoply of other species coming on board. So, you know, there are different strategies that are utilized right now. We need to isolate out some of the substrate streams in order to more efficiently decompose this material. Because when you have a hodgepodge mixture, it's a lot more complicated to develop a single fungal strategy to break that down, as opposed to separating out leaves and twigs and bark, etc.
Okay, Jim, thanks for your call. To East Aurora, New York now, and Alan's joining us. Hi, Alan.
Hi. When I will go walking into my woods and I find unusual, desirable mushrooms, I always ask myself the one question. Do I cut them and enjoy the instant harvest, or do I leave them be? And in so doing, do I increase the amount that will be there next year and years after that?
Well, that's the big question in the field of mycology. Matsutake hunters typically twist and pull out the mushrooms gently. Though I always believe that you should leave the majority of the mushrooms in place in the environment and only take a small portion of them, because there'd be more parent mushrooms to release spores. So I think that's very important. But the mere fact that you're picking the mushrooms, now you have become a vector, a vehicle for spore dispersal. So now you are spreading, and you've engaged that species, and it probably likes to be spread. So it's a very complicated question, because our knowledge base right now is extremely limited. But I recommend that you don't always pick all the mushrooms, and you pick the most mature ones. And by carrying them around, and by the way, don't throw them in the garbage. Throw them in your backyard. Throw them into your compost pile, because they're a spore mass there, and you can utilize that.
Do you harvest the mushrooms to eat them, Alan?
Yes, I was so joyed. This is the first time I've ever found morels in my place this year, and left them alone, put tires around them so the deer wouldn't bother them, and hopefully they'll increase next year.
Thanks a lot for your call.
Thank you.
Nice to have you on the program. Paul, tell me something. If there are, in fact, 6 million species of different kinds of fungi, and that we know maybe 500,000 of them, how long is it going to take before the science on this is sort of rock solid and the mushrooms are being used at the level and in the places and by the people who you say should be using them?
It depends upon the public. I recommend that you support your local mycologist, and you know, please support, especially in elementary schools and high schools, programs specifically on saprophytic fungi and mycorrhizal fungi. Hawksworth estimates there's 1 to 2 million species of fungi in the world. But the more that we study, the more we realize there are more species out there. So we're just at the very, very beginning of this. And I think it's absolutely imperative that we look at our natural genome as a very important part of our national heritage. You know, we value monuments by Thomas Jefferson, et cetera. Well, we should be looking at these forests as national monuments because of their genomic diversity. This is critically important. There's this mushroom, Brigiopores nobilissimus, the noble polypore. It is the first mushroom ever to be put on an endangered species list. It was the largest mushroom in the world in the Guinness Book of World Records. It grows up to 300 pounds. It's in the old growth forest, exclusive to that domain, and it doesn't rot. How a mushroom that's soft, that you can cut with a butter knife, is fuzzy, will not rot in these environments, which are otherwise so hostile to many other organisms, really suggests that there is a complex biological system in play there that we have very little understanding about it.
Paul, I have to stop you there, but because we're out of time. But thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
Mycologist Paul Stamets, founder of Fungi Perfecti, a mushroom cultivation and research business in Washington State. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection.